Well, for a lot of people, fall means football, and if you're a Wisconsin football fan, you likely spent Friday night watching the Badger game. Larry Mueller here, and on the show today, we're talking about Badgers football team with our guest, Jim Polzine. Great to have him with us again. He's sports reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal, also hosts the Open Gym podcast for Badger Extra, writes for Badger Extra as well. And it does a great job. As we talk with Jim, I hope you'll join in. What questions do you have about the Badgers? What do you expect of the Badgers for the rest of the season? Did you go to the game Friday night? Love to hear your thoughts. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Jim Polzine, good to have you back. Thanks for joining in.
Yeah, thanks for having me again.
Well, Friday night, the Badgers won against Western Michigan, but it certainly wasn't an easy win. Let's talk about some of the takeaways from the game. Likes and dislikes. I guess there were a few things to like about the game.
Yeah, let's go to their offense first. I like the fact that they can put together 15 and 16 play drives. I don't think that can be overlooked. It's not easy to stay on the field and move the chains and do that over and over and over. So that is a positive, that they were able to sustain drives without penalty killer or turnovers and all that. That's the like part of that, of the offense. The dislike is you need to have some big plays once in a while. They ran 82 plays offensively. They didn't have one over 20 yards. That's not something that you can do, and that will not sustain throughout a season. You need to have big plays, big chunk plays, just to make your life a little bit easier on you.
Well, Tyler Van Dyke, as a quarterback, is at least half responsible for those big plays. What are your thoughts on his debut?
I thought he was a little uneven, and maybe to be expected. He's a debut. You're going to be a little nervous. He comes here with something to prove after the way things ended at Miami. So I don't know how much of that was on his mind. You know, just kind of coming out and making a great debut instead of just kind of playing your game. I thought he forced things at times, got a little bit greedy with a couple of his throws, and almost got intercepted a couple times in the red zone.
Just lucky.
Right, absolutely. And so, you know, I don't think it was bad. I don't think it was great. Somewhere in the middle, and I think if you can clean up some of those decisions going into week two, that will bode well for him.
I'm willing to bet you would agree with me that the special teams play was not up to par.
No, I get grade. You know, part of my job responsibility after games is to grade the offense, defense, special teams, and just overall. I had the special teams as an F until they recovered that fumble on the punt. I mean, I just thought there were some things within the game, a missed field goal, you know, some decision-making stuff in terms of kickoffs, and it just was not a great performance until that play. And I don't want to, you know, poo-poo that play, because that was a game-turning play. If that fumble recovery doesn't happen, Wisconsin's down one at that point. I don't know how that game plays out in the fourth quarter.
Yeah.
So not an F performance, but I think I gave it a D-.
You know, what bothered me the most about special teams, Western Michigan is going to kick a field goal, and
yes.
I said, watch out for a fake. I mean, it just...
Right, because Western Michigan is down 6 at that point. They just missed one from a similar length. The field goal doesn't do a ton of good at that point of the game. So I would have been on high alert, certainly. The play they ran, credit to Western Michigan, that play was nifty.
It was well executed.
Yeah. But yes, I thought there was a little bit of lack of awareness there and ended up biting them.
Yeah, yeah. Jim and Jane in Madison has something for us. Hi, Jane.
I just wanted to say, I want to give a shout out to Jim. I'm not a sports person. We still get the State Journal, and I will read his column because I love your writing.
Thank you, Jane. That means a lot. I appreciate it. For anybody out there that listens, I appreciate the people that still get the paper. I know there's a lot of different ways you can get to us now, online, paper, but love hearing that, and it was nice of you to call in and say that.
Yeah, thanks, Jane. I get the paper too, Jane, so there you go. Appreciate it very much. You can join in too at 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. Historically, you know, the Badgers have been considered a very physical team, but that certainly didn't come through for me on Saturday. I'm sorry, Friday. What do you think? What can the program do to regain that reputation? Or maybe was this just, you know, the first game or whatever?
Yeah, I do want to get more of a sample size before I jump to any grand conclusions, but it's somewhat alarming coming off last season when I think both sides of the lines were issues, and you wanted to see the improvement there. I think the biggest question mark I had going into this season was on the defensive side of the ball, defensive line. I just didn't think they were super deep there. I've said this a couple of times in talks leading into the season. Kendall Benton was a really good player here a couple of years ago. He's playing for the Steelers now. He was a difference maker, a guy you had to account for if you're an offense. I don't think they have that guy on the defensive line right now. And James Thompson Jr. would have been that guy. He's hurt and probably out for the season, or most of it anyways. So that was a big loss heading into the season. Offensively, I thought the offensive line played okay. That's still an area that worries me because while I like their starting five, the depth behind that group is very, very young. If they would lose one or two starters from that group, I think you get pretty young in a hurry. And so that's where my eyes are going to be all season, because I think, you know, if you want to diagnose the issues within this program over the last 5 years or so, this offensive line has not lived up to the standard that some of their best teams have had. And trying to put a finger on why that is, I don't know that I've gotten there yet, but I know it's an issue.
Yeah. And I was amazed that Western Michigan kept running on the left side of our line and making yards.
Yeah, because if that happens in week one, you do worry about what the Alabamas and other Big Ten teams are going to do.
Yeah. I guess on the positive side, despite, you know, could have been better offensive line, I thought the backs played pretty well.
Yeah, and they have numbers there. I think that's the one thing that jumps out about that group is, you know, I don't think there's a Jonathan Taylor in that group necessarily, but last year you had Braylon Allen and Ches Malusi, and you didn't know what you had behind them. And when when Ches Malusi got hurt, it's Braylon Allen carrying a lot of the load, and then he kind of got dinged up. They have really made over that group. They brought in a couple freshmen that we didn't even see Friday night. Darian Dupree and Dylan Jones are two guys that flashed throughout training camp. We didn't see them Friday night, but I think we will at some point. And then the two starters, Ches Malusi and Tawi Walker, I think are a solid 1-2 punch. Cade Iacomelli is a guy I didn't know what kind of role he would face, and he ended up having the longest run of the night, which was 12 yards. So I think they have some. I think they have numbers there. I think they have some flexibility just in terms of how they use these guys. And ideally, Larry, you want to keep these guys fresh late into the season. I think they'll be able to do that this year.
Last season, the Badgers went 7-6. How does their 2023 the schedule this year compared to what they face
night and day? This might be I was going to do this at some point. I never got to it. This might be as difficult of a schedule on paper as they've had as long as I can remember. If you just look at from the AP rankings, five of the teams that they're going to face this season were in the preseason top 25, three in the top 10, and that doesn't take into account the other teams that are kind of fringe top 25 teams. Like, I think Nebraska is going to be better this year. I think that trip to Rutgers in October is not going to be easy. Trips to Northwestern are never easy. So there's three games that if you're an optimistic Badger fan, you kind of have those chalked up as wins. And I would put them in the toss-up category. So, and I thought last year's schedule was manageable. Yeah. And one of the reasons why I thought they'd go 10-2 is because I thought, if you look at it, I think they're favored in 11 of them. And that just, you know, they lost some games that they probably weren't expected to. And if that happens again this year, then it's going to be tough to get to 500.
Yeah. Do you think they can make 8 wins?
So, Larry, thinking throughout training camp, I had them at 7-5 all season. And then late in training camp, I think I got optimistic, maybe overly optimistic, and I thought they'd get to 8-4, which I think would be a considering the schedule, would be a impressive season. 8-4, I know it doesn't sound very impressive in the grand scheme of things, but I think based on the schedule, it would signify to me progress in year two of the Luke Fickell era.
And you did write in your column that the Badgers are better this year than they were last.
I think they are better, Larry. I do. I mean, like, I thought from what I saw in camp and in the spring, I think the roster has been upgraded, and I also thought the returning guys would have more comfort in the systems, both offensively and defense. I think that was part of the problem last year, is you're getting used to new schemes, and there's a little bit of a growing pains period. So I think that, you know, I thought that would improve into year two, and not saying it can't. We certainly didn't see a ton of that Friday night. But, yes, I think you look at this roster, 2023 compared to 24, it's better. But my caveat to that was I don't know that the record is going to be better because the schedule is much more difficult.
Jim Polzin, our guest today. Great to have him with us, a sports writer for the Wisconsin State Journal. And great to have him with us today. Questions for him? Give a call. The number is 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. We're taking a look at Badger football today with our guest. It's great to have with us Jim Polzin, sports reporter for the State Journal. You can join in again at 800-642-1234, email to talk@WPR.org. Just a quick reminder, at noon we'll hear from a weightlifter who made her way to the Olympics, and then we'll learn more about curling ahead of the matchup between Team USA and Team Canada, which is pretty cool. It's a kind of a first. So, again, join in, 800-642-1234, email to talk@WPR.org. I want to go back to the offensive line for just a minute. So, you're more or less happy with the first five that we've got?
Yeah, and a lot of that has to do with the experience level. The two tackles, Jack Nelson and Riley Malman, have just played a lot of football here. They need to make a jump, no doubt about it, but I think that can happen. The interior, Joe Huber played a lot of football last year. Joe Brunner is a state kid who's playing left guard now. Came here as a pretty highly regarded recruit, kind of a bulldozer type, really a traditional Wisconsin guy, kind of the old days Wisconsin guy. And then in the middle, Jake Renfro is the center. He came with Luke Fickell and company from Cincinnati, started on a team that went to the playoffs there. A lot of experience there. So I like that five. Is it outstanding? That remains to be seen, right? I mean, I think we're so spoiled around here to some degree that we've had a lot of years where the offensive line was just, you know, they had All-Americans on it. I don't know if there's any All-Americans on this group, but I think it can improve. But like I said before, it's after that that it gets a little dicey. There's a lot of good, young, highly regarded recruits in the system, but we just haven't seen enough of them to know if they can play.
Well, they're young guys.
They're young, yeah.
18, 19 years old.
And one thing to remember, too, with this group, Larry, is they've, you know, like Jack Nelson, the left tackle, is on his fourth position coach in as many years. They've been a lot of changes on that offensive line front, and that's, I don't think that's great. I mean, I'm a big fan of continuity for a lot of years here. Bob Bostad was the offensive line coach, then Joe Rudolph before that, guys like Jim Huber. They were here 8, 9, 10 years, and there's the ability to have this continuity within the pipeline, and that just hasn't happened of late, and I think that's part of the problem.
Yeah, I think so, too. And maybe why we're not getting the line, the offensive and defensive lines. I mean, practically all of them were from Wisconsin at some point, and now they're going other places.
Yeah, I mean, they've you know, if you look at recruiting, they've missed out on some high end kids in state. There was in Brunner's class, there was a guy named Carson Hinsman who Ohio State came in and got over Wisconsin. There's a kid, Billy Shrouth, who's down at Notre Dame, and Wisconsin recruited him. So they've lost some head-to-head battles with some power programs. I think that's one thing that's happened lately, too, is that I think bigger programs have recognized that the talent level and the skill level of Wisconsin offensive linemen, both sides of the ball really, is high. And now Wisconsin, it used to be that you had this wall around Wisconsin, you could count on the best players staying. It's easier than ever to leave. And we haven't even talked about NIL yet.
Yeah,
right?
I know. We'll get to that.
Okay, that's a we'll game changer.
John in Sun Prairie has something. Let's go there. Hi, John.
Hi, Jim. Enjoy your column when I see it in the State Journal. Just had a question on the total blow up of the football program several years ago with Paul Chryst leaving. Do you think where do you think we are on a scale now? Are we still in the building stage? Was it worth it to go through all that? Or has this gotten us something that we can really build on for the future? Kind of, what's your opinion on it?
Yeah, good question, John. I mean, I think I would say this. I would preach patience as much as possible. Luke Fickell's in year two. I think it does take a new coach, even in this new era. I think it takes a coach 3 to 4 years before you can get your guys in the system, get your guys developmentally ready. And so I don't know if this process is going to happen overnight. You certainly want to see progress. You know, I think it's fair to judge a team by progress it's making. But I think Luke Fickell was brought here to contend for championships. That's what Chryst McIntosh said. And if that's not happening in, you know, year four, I think that certainly is, a scary proposition and something that needs to be looked at closer. But we're early in year two. I think that's fair to kind of hit the brakes and evaluate where this program is year to year. I would have said this to you. I've been pretty consistent in what I've said about blowing up the program. I felt like a change needed to be made. I think the more you learned after the fact that it was time in this new era of NIL and transfer portal to change things up. I probably at the time would have hired Jim Leonard, only because Jim Leonard's a guy that everything he's touched in his career, both as a player and as a coach, has turned to gold. I thought he deserved a chance to kind of prove what he got or what he could do. I understand, however, Chryst McIntosh's decision to go with someone that was proven. I mean, Luke Fickell was a guy that was up for jobs at LSU and USC and Notre Dame. Really a guy that was highly thought of in this business, a guy that had led Cincinnati to a playoff, a guy that had sent a lot of guys into the NFL. So if you're looking at Jim Leonard versus Luke Fickell at the time and you want to go with the proven commodity and a guy that'll maybe come in and change the culture and like you said, blow things up in terms of everything, weight room, staff, recruiting department. I understand why Chryst McIntosh did what he did. And I think now we just kind of need to sit back and see how it turns out. And I don't know that we're going to have that answer this year, certainly.
Yeah. John, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Jim in Wausau, we'll give you a chance now. Hi, Jim. Thanks for calling.
Hello. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can.
Okay, I'm wondering if our guest thinks our quarterback position, Tyler Van Dyke, is an upgrade over last year's quarterback, Tanner Mordecai.
That's a great question. I don't know that it's too early to say for sure. I mean, I did get to watch 3 weeks of camp, and I don't know that it's hard to evaluate the two. They're so different. Tanner Mordecai was a guy that could run a little bit better, I think. I don't know that we ever saw the true Tanner Mordecai either last year. Got injured. Was really handcuffed by being the first guy in this system where a lot of guys around him didn't maybe understand the air raid or were still kind of trying to get used to it. So I don't know that a true evaluation could ever take place. I mean, to be fair, Mordecai went out and earned a job on the practice squad with the 49ers. I think he's pretty highly thought of in this by football people. I don't know that we saw the true Tanner Mordecai last year. Tyler Van Dyke's an interesting prospect. If you go back to his freshman year at Miami, he was the ACC Rookie of the Year. Had a great year. At that point of his career, people were looking at him as a potential first or second day pick in the NFL draft if he kind of kept it up. He didn't. Struggled with injuries, struggled with kind of losing favor with the Miami staff, and his last 2 years just ended up kind of going backwards and ended up losing his job. So you look at him, and I'm sure you guys saw it too, whether you're at the game or on TV. Arm strength is there. I think he can fit the ball in a lot of windows. He can throw the deep ball, even though we didn't really see that play out on Friday night. I still think there's a good quarterback in there, but it's going to be up to him and really the guys around him to prove that. I don't know if they've upgraded. I don't know that I would say that it was a drastic downgrade either, though.
Yeah. Jim, thanks a lot for calling. That reminded me of Graham Mertz. I watched the Florida-Miami game.
Yeah.
A friend of mine is a big Florida fan, and they were ecstatic about getting Graham Mertz. And I think Florida doesn't have an offensive line, at least pass protection, very much.
Yeah, and his numbers last year were good. I think a lot of people, if they just look at stats, they were good.
He was first in the SEC, and I think fourth in the nation.
Yeah.
74% or 5% passing.
Right, but if you look, I mean, if you kind of break that down, and I saw him play a couple times last year, especially in the big games, he was not great. And again, like, that's judging an offense by one person is never fair, because there's always people around and there's guy calling the plays. There's a lot of factors that go into how successful a passing game is. But I think we saw in week one against Miami some of the issues that Graham Mertz had here still exist at Florida.
Yeah, absolutely. And speaking of watching games, I did watch the USC and LSU game.
Yeah.
Talk about two really good. That was a great game to watch with a couple of really great quarterbacks.
It's funny, Larry, we were talking about what you expect from this team, and I made a change late in camp that I thought this team could go 8-4, and I had kind of been at the 7-5 mark all camp. One of the reasons why was, the more I thought about that USC game, I thought that was a game they could win. I just thought they could go in there and Wisconsin could be more physical, and maybe catch a USC team that was coming off kind of a rough season. I tell you what, after watching Wisconsin play Friday night and USC play on Saturday, I think I've changed my mind on that game, because I was impressed by USC's quarterback, and I was impressed by how physical USC was.
Yeah, very physical. John in Sun Prairie, we'll go to you now. Hi, John.
Hi, Jim. I just wanted to try to find out how much the Badgers basketball and football programs have available for NIL spending. I had heard that Store got some extreme amounts when he left UW and the NIL, and I just wondered, what do we have a budget, or how do they work that out?
Yeah, I'll try to break this down as best I can. I think one of the issues with NIL in general is there's not a lot of transparency. We don't, unlike the NFL, where there's a salary cap and we know players' salaries, they don't have to disclose that at the college level. There's a lot you can do kind of behind the scenes, and it starts to creep into what the rumors are and stuff. Like you mentioned AJ Store, that figure I think was all over social media and maybe even reported in the news, reached as high as 7 figures from what we heard, right? And Wisconsin certainly doesn't have it in the budget to pay one player that much money. I know less about the football situation than I do about basketball, and that's only because I sat down with Greg Gard, I think it was May or June, and he did a really good job of breaking down for me what the NIL game looks like in terms of what he's doing. He kind of branched off on his own to a certain degree, kind of took the bull by the horns and started a thing called a six-man society, and it's kind of under the umbrella of the Varsity Collective, but it's really a lot of Greg Gard and his staff going out to donors and you know, asking for money and telling them why NIL is important and why they have to do this to keep up with the Joneses. And the figure he gave me, I believe, was somewhere between $3 to $5 million. If you're going to compete these days, you need to be between $3 and $5 million per year from an NIL standpoint. And that's not going to compete with the North Carolinas and Dukes and Alabamas of the world, but that's going to keep you in that kind of that fair price range. So I think that's, if I had to guess, that's where Wisconsin basketball is at, somewhere, I would say somewhere in the middle of that $3 to $5 million range. But that's got to, you know, if you could, let's put the number at $4 million. That doesn't get you, you're certainly not going to spend $1 million of that on AJ Store. You're not going to spend high six figures on a Chucky Hepburn. And you got to be creative about the way you spend money, because you need 7, 8, 9 good players to create a good team.
You know, just to go along with that, I've noticed he's gone in international a lot. And I wonder if that's part of the strategy.
It absolutely is. I mean, I think the NIL game, it's a little bit complicated, but it's not, it's trickier. The visa rules are different. International players can get NIL money. It's different in the way they have to do it. So, and I certainly think you're not talking about the salaries, that is the word I'm going to use, because that's essentially what they are. You're not talking about paying international players as much as you are if you're recruiting against Illinois or Iowa or somebody for a kid from the Midwest.
Someone told me or had said they had read that the player of the year last year, of course, is from Canada, did not get from Purdue get any NIL money.
No, I would highly doubt that. Yeah, because you can, like I said, there are ways that international players can earn NIL without losing their visa, and part of it is they could, like Zach Edey at Purdue could get NIL money in Canada. Like you can hold your own camps in Canada, and or some other sort of way of using your name, image, and likeness if you're in the country, and that certainly is fair game. I think the trick becomes when you come into the States and start to do that. It gets a little bit trickier.
Someone else emails in about Phil Longo, the air raid offense. Explain the air raid offense, what do you think of it?
Yeah, we're still waiting to see some of the explosion that Phil Longo. I mean, listen, I'm not gonna rip on Phil Longo. His track record prior to coming to Wisconsin was pretty good at North Carolina for 4 years, at Mississippi for 2 years. Prior to that, he was at the FCS level and leading teams to playoffs and conference championships. He's had success everywhere he went. Air Raid, I think, can give people the wrong impression. I think people thought he would come in here and just throw the ball around at will and Wisconsin would become this pass happy offense. And that's even from day one, he said, I like to run the ball. I'm not going to go away from Wisconsin's strengths. He likes balance. I think in a perfect world, he would like 50-50 split. In fact, he's been very adamant this year that he's used as a stat that over the last 13 years of his offense, I think they've run the ball 18 more times than they've passed it, or maybe it's the other way around, but it's close. I think the problem has been certainly finding the right efficiency from a passing standpoint where you can hit some big plays once in a while. There just weren't enough big plays last year, and certainly in the opener there weren't any big plays. You want to find that right balance where you can mix good passing, open up things in the running game, and we just haven't seen that yet. I use this crazy stat, Larry, that they haven't scored. Wisconsin's program hasn't scored 40 points in a game since Jim Leonard's debut as interim head coach midway through the 22 season. So you're talking about a season and a half plus now that they haven't hit 40 points in a game. And why is that number important? It's a little bit of a, arbitrary number, but 40 points these days in college football is a number that programs hit week in and week out. And Wisconsin hasn't done it in, I think, going on 20 games now. That's just, it seems like something's off. I want to caution to not jump to conclusions after one game, but this offense needs to pick it up this season. They averaged 23 points last season. That's not enough. You need to add to that.
Yeah, and part of it seemed to be finishing a little bit, and that was last year too.
And that's one knock on the air raid is that when you spread a team out and you try to use vertical passing, easier to do between the 20s because there's more space. Once you get down to the red zone, you don't have that backspace anymore. The end zone's there. It's a little bit easier to defend, and you got to be better. You got to be more creative. You got to find guys in the middle. They really want guys to pick up in their, it's called yak, yards after catch, where you're catching a ball, you've got some space. Receivers can kind of show their what they have moves wise and quickness wise. Just didn't see enough of that in the opener. Didn't see any balls. I think they threw one deep ball. So I'd like to see more of that heading into the Alabama game.
So what did you think of the receivers? We had two receivers that kind of stood, one of redshirt freshmen.
Yeah, Will Pauling is, I'll get to him first. Will Pauling is a guy who caught 70-plus balls last year. I think they'd like that number to drop just because of that. I think they'd like more balance from the receiving standpoint. I think the way Luke Fickell put it is he'd like his receptions number to drop, but his receiving yards to go up, meaning that yard per catch is going to go up. And that's, again, kind of what I'm talking about with big plays. I think he's a playmaker on this team. Tretch Kekahuna is the redshirt freshman you're referring to. We saw a little bit in the bowl game last year against LSU what he could do, and a little bit in the opener, too. He's a guy that if he gets the ball in space, I think he's going to make some things happen. So I think you can count on those two. One issue is they play the same position. You know, it's there's they can get them on the field at the same time, but it's not going to be super frequent. I think where this offense needs to take a jump this year is the guys on the outside, the outside receivers, Bryson Green, Vinny Anthony, CJ Williams. Williams and Bryson Green were two of the more highly regarded transfers that Wisconsin brought in a year ago. And I just don't think we've seen the production from them that maybe we thought we'd see.
Yeah, that's interesting. One point I think it was kind of interesting is that the transfer portal brought in some quarterbacks from December. Who are, you know, talk about those guys.
Actually, it was like last December. It was last December. And Tanner Mordecai was one of them.
Yeah, it was one of them, but there were some others.
Yeah, Braden Locke. Who's a guy we saw last year. He was a backup last year. He lost the job again this year. He's a backup. Only a sophomore. I think there's a world this year where even if Van Dyke starts the whole season, Braden Locke has shown enough that he's your starting quarterback in 2025. I think that's ideally what they'd like to do, Larry, because Luke Fickell is on the record saying, I don't want to go to the transfer portal every year to find a quarterback. I don't want one-year solutions every year. So I think in a perfect world, Braden Locke wins that job next spring and is your quarterback for the next 2 years. Nick Evers is a guy, they highly regarded guy they brought in the transfer portal last year. He is already transferred out of the program. He's a starting quarterback at Connecticut, although he got hurt in the opener. So there's been, it's a little bit of the way of the world this year, these days in college football is you get transfers, but they're not necessarily guys who will stick around. And I think we're kind of seeing that. One guy I want to mention that's not a transfer that they brought in the recruiting class last year is maybe Metoyer. He's from Texas. Pretty highly regarded. Saw a little bit of him in camp. A guy that's not ready yet, and nor would you really expect him to be ready as a true freshman. I think he could maybe compete with Braden Locke next year for that starting job. I think if it's December, Larry, and we're talking in mid-December that Wisconsin's looking in the transfer portal for a quarterback, I think Luke Fickell would consider that a failure because that means the guys within the system are not developing and you're having to go out year after year after year to plug a gap at quarterback, which is a place you want. The word we used before with the offensive line is continuity. You want that at the quarterback position too.
And it's interesting. I mean, if the thing now is the players can leave.
Yeah.
And if you've got reasonably good quarterback and a reasonably good backup, if the backup doesn't like being the backup, the backup can be gone.
And not just that, if the starter has, like, let's say it's not going to happen this year, Tyler Van Dyke's a senior, he can't go anywhere. But if you have, and this is any position, if you have a really good underclassman who's a player, you have to re-recruit him these days. And that's every sport, basketball, volleyball, football. You have to re-recruit those players to make sure you can keep them. And they're hearing through the grapevine how much they'd be worth at another place. It's just, it's free agency, and it's unlimited free agency because in the old days, if you were going to transfer from program A to B, you had to sit out a year. And then there was a rule where you could have one transfer in your college career. Now you can transfer every year. You can go play in four schools in 4 years. That's not an ideal setup if you're a coach who has to manage a roster year to year.
Had a guy on the show 2 years ago, I think, we were talking sports and we were talking about admissions. And he said, well, Wisconsin and Northwestern get kind of screwed, is how he put it, because of our admission requirements are more stringent, shall we say, than others.
Yeah, I think that's true to a degree. That's another thing that, you know, it's you're not going to, transparency is an issue there because you're talking about privacy, student privacy records. But I do know that they've gone after guys that they have not been able to get into school for various reasons. And I think, frankly, they're, you know, if you're a football, basketball, volleyball coach, you're looking, the first thing you're doing when you see a player you like is you're looking at the high school transcript or college transcript, as it may be. And they're deciding to not even recruit a player because they know there's no chance they'll get him through admission. So I think there's truth to that. I don't know if it's overblown to some degree. I think Northwestern standards are certainly much higher than Wisconsin's. But I do think there are programs that Wisconsin's competing with both in the Big Ten and beyond the Big Ten where those standards are less and Wisconsin's having to make some tough decisions academically.
Yeah. Jim Polzin, our guest sports reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal. Join in with your questions. Number to call, 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. 402-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks so much for joining us today on WPR News Special Sports Day today, as we do the first Tuesday of every month. And great to have back Jim Polzin, sports reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal, talking about Badgers sports with him today. Zeroed in a bit on football. We could take some other areas as well as we move along. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. Talk@WPR.org. Here's another email. Do we have some stars coming up in the pipeline?
Yeah, that was so when the season started, I wrote, you know, kind of related to this tough schedule that, hey, if the record looks the same as it did last year, there are other ways to measure progress. And one of them I wanted to see was, are there young guys that we can count on being difference makers? And my theory, and I wrote this the other night, is I don't think there's enough game changers, difference makers, studs, whatever word you want to use, great players in the system right now, are proven, certainly. But are there some young guys that have come through these first couple recruiting classes for Luke Fickell? To that, I would say yes. I mean, we mentioned one of them, Tretch Ketkahun, who's only a redshirt freshman. The two running backs I mentioned before, Darian Dupree and Dylan Jones, I think in time will be potential all Big Ten type players. In the back end of the defense, Xavier Lucas, he had an interception the other night, I think is a guy that is going to play a lot of football this year already, and I think he's going to be a really good player in his college career. They've got some more in these recruiting classes. Thomas Heiberger is an outside linebacker. They've got another outside linebacker. I think there are some guys. I hesitate to label them as difference makers this early without having seen it, but I do like these first two recruiting classes that Luke Fickell's put together, and now it's just a matter of how can those guys develop and how quickly can they develop?
Yeah, and it's from a fan perspective, it's hard to tell how these guys are progressing.
And frankly, Larry, I didn't mention a quarterback, and that's a little bit of the issue. In college football, you need a great player at quarterback if you're going to be a great team. That's probably a little too far, but I strongly believe that if you're going to be great, you need a very, very good player at that position. And I don't know that Wisconsin has that in the pipeline yet. It's way too early to say. They've got Mabry Matoyer, I mentioned earlier. Braden Locke is a guy that's been okay. They've got Braden Locke's little brother, Landon Locke, is committed. He'll be here next fall. And they've got another quarterback in the 2026 class. I guess the bottom line, Larry, is they have to hit. They have to hit on a guy at that position if this program's going to take the step that it needs to take against in a world now where the Big Ten is bigger and better than ever.
I look back at the quarterbacks that we've had over the years, and we've had some good quarterbacks, but they're probably not what one would consider the very top of the line quarterbacks.
Russell Wilson, right?
That's kind of the standard.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, you know, I don't know how many Russell Wilsons you're going to find. And that was a unique situation where he had played 3 years at NC State and then transferred in. It's certainly finding that guy in the high school ranks and develop him would be more ideal, because then you have him as a starter for a couple years. I would take a season Scott Tolzien had the year before Russell Wilson arrived. I would take a season like Jack Cohn had in 2019. I'd take a season like Alex Hornibrook had in 2017. And again, I say that focusing on one player at one position, those guys, if you look through their seasons, they all had good offensive lines in front of them, good running backs to kind of balance and be compliments, and pretty good receivers, right? It's an entire package, and sometimes it's easy, and I do this too. I'm guilty of this. You ding a quarterback based on some stuff that's happening around him that's really not up to him.
Yeah, and Tyler Van Dyke, I mean, he got nailed.
He did.
Practically right away.
Helmet to helmet. Yeah. And I wonder how much that impacted him, because if you saw the rest of the game, he was happy feet, a little bit of happy feet, which is understandable. And so we'll see if that's an issue all season.
Yeah. It'll be hard. Well, here you've got, who was it? Hunter Waller.
Yeah.
Saw a special, he said, you know, we're going to have a special season this year. Where was he coming from, do you think?
I think he believes that. I really do. He's from Muskego, highly regarded, could have gone anywhere 4 years ago. has been a really good player here. I think will be a, for my money, the best player on this roster. If I had to list this roster 1 through 120 or whatever it is, Hunter Wohler's name goes on the top without a doubt. Could have absolutely left after last season. Could have left 2 seasons ago after the coaching transition. Could have left last season after the things didn't go very well. And he could have played almost anywhere. I think there would have been a long line of really good programs. So if his goal was to make the playoffs, to go win a conference championship, Hunter Wohler certainly would have had that opportunity. He decided to stay, and I do think he believes this program will make a jump this year. I don't know that I'm going to criticize him for saying that's overly optimistic. Those guys know the program inside and out better than I do. We're not there every day like they are. So I think Hunter Wohler looks around and says, hey, if A, B, C, D happen, this team could be really good. And I think there's truth in that, Larry. Like, I think if you list the things of ifs and ands, then it could go right. It's there. I think the talent is here. And if you win some close games, one of this program's biggest issues in the last 4 years has been it has failed to finish close games in the fourth quarter, and it's lost some games that you think, this could have gone either way. You know, if that happens, a 9-4 season 2 years ago becomes, or 3 years ago, excuse me, becomes 11-2. 2 years ago, 7-6 becomes 9-4 or 10-3. Mm-hmm. So I don't think this program's far off. I think it's certainly, there's a ways to go. There's a pretty big gap between the Wisconsins and Ohio States and Michigans and probably Oregon now of the world. But I don't think the gap's so tight with, I think this program still could be a top 25-ish type team.
Yeah, we're better. There were some years. I mean, remember, we won two Rose Bowls in a row. Big Ten champions. We've had some really good scores. And here's an email from Paul. In your opinion, when was Wisconsin's last signature victory?
Yeah, that's a great one. They beat Iowa, I believe, at some point during the 2021 season. Went 9-4. They went up to Minnesota and had a chance, if they win that game, to win the Big Ten West. I believe there was a win over a ranked Iowa team in that mix. Other than that, you have to go back to, I don't know. I don't even know if there was one. They went to the Rose Bowl in 2019, but I'm not sure there was a quote unquote signature victory in that mix. It's been a while. And I think it's an absolutely great thing to point out that's one thing that's been lacking over the last 7 years. I think if you look at a little bit of the 7 year itch, they have not had a first round draft pick in the last 7 years, 2017 when they had TJ Watt, and Ryan Ramczyk. So it's been 7 years. It's a long time to go for a Big Ten program like Wisconsin to go without a first round draft pick. And that's kind of what I get to not having the stars in the system and not developing them has been a problem.
TJ Watt. I remember when the Packers passed on him.
Still paying for that one.
Oh, I just wrung my hands when he was passed over. Well, here's another one. Another email. What do you think of the Big Ten expansion? Maybe when is enough enough?
Yeah, it's because I don't know that it's done. I really don't know that this expansion era is over yet. The ACC, that's kind of a conference that I think there will be movement in once their deal with ESPN runs out, which who knows when that's going to be, because there's going to be court. There's already fights in the courts about it. What do I think about the Big Ten? I got to admit, Larry, I come at this from a very selfish perspective as a media member, and that's that I like new storylines. I like difference. I like traveling new places on the weekend. So I don't know that I'm looking at it through the same lens as a fan does. I'm looking forward to the game against Oregon. I'm looking forward to going out to Coliseum and seeing Wisconsin play LSU. Washington and UCLA are intriguing programs, not just from a football standpoint, from other sports, volleyball, basketball. So I understand where the fans are coming from. They want tradition. And they're certainly right. It's still a little odd to call it Big Ten the Big Ten when it's 18 teams and who knows how much it'll eventually grow. But when the news first came out that there was going to be 4 new Big Ten teams, I kind of scoffed at it, but I've come to accept it and tried to look for the positives in it.
And you meant USC, going to see USC, not LSU.
Oh, did I say LSU? Yes. Sorry, USC. Who knows? Maybe LSU is in the Big Ten someday.
Well, for me, it's a little tough to take two. The whole business of winning the Big Ten anymore, it almost seems like an impossible task.
Yeah, and I think fans need to take that into account in terms of expectation level. Let's go to the basketball side for a second, Larry. Bo Ryan had this amazing stat where he never finished worse than fourth in the Big Ten. He did that in a league that was, most of the time he was there, 11 teams. Got to be 14 at the end. But now, if there's 18 teams in the league, it's harder to finish. It's almost like a top six finish is if you're finishing the top 33% of the conference, that's commendable. So you kind of got to change your expectations to some degree. Certainly you want to compete for champ. You want to be in the running for championships late into the season. You don't want to be out and kind of looking up at the standings and realize there's no chance. But you do kind of have to recalibrate the way you evaluate programs these days.
Yeah, and when we think about the playoffs and Wisconsin making the playoffs, even is with this new system, 12 teams. But, five are already picked, automatics.
I think if you finish the top three of the Big Ten these days, you're going to be in. I think even now, if you finish in the top four, I mean, my guess is we'll see how it plays out, but I think the SEC will probably get four teams most years. I think the Big Ten is going to get four teams most years, strictly from a strength of schedule standpoint. I think the Big 12, ACC, probably aren't as strong top to bottom, and I think that's going to work in the Big Ten's favor. But, like you said, getting to the top three or four of an 18-team league is not anything that's very easy.
And I'm just looking. I don't know if I'm looking forward to this, but the amount of travel and time zones and everything else, I just wonder how that's going to affect.
Yeah, and I worry about it more from a football, not so much, because you're playing games on the weekends for the most part. Basketball, volleyball, certainly the non-revenue sports, right? The soccers and those sports. I think basketball is going to. Certainly this is a wise move. If Wisconsin plays at USC and UCLA, it'll be one trip. You'll go out to LA, play them on a Thursday, Saturday, or Friday, Sunday. Or if you go out to Oregon, Washington, same thing. It'll be a Thursday, Saturday, Friday, Sunday thing. So you're not making that trip multiple times. You're making it once, and you're staying out there. And they're going to try to, make it more manageable on the student athlete, or as manageable as possible on the student athlete.
Yeah. And as I chaired the student grades and so forth section, and I'm thinking, well, if it's a Thursday, Saturday, they got to leave on Wednesday.
Absolutely.
And so now it's Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. You're missing classes.
Well, I will say this now, Larry, is that especially post-COVID, classes are largely, you can attend them online.
Yeah.
I know I spoke for a journalism class here, and it was online. It was a Zoom thing. So I think there's ways around that. I think we can get into a whole discussion about academics, and I think it's better in person. Like, heck, this interview with you today, Larry, is better in person than it would be over the phone, right?
Absolutely.
And I think the same thing is with class, is if I'm in this classroom and staring at the professor and taking down notes, I think it's it's easier to stay focused and the distractions aren't quite there as easy as if you're, on Zoom.
What do you pick for Wisconsin football finish, and what do you pick for Wisconsin basketball finish, man?
I'm sticking with 8-4 for football, even though I have a lot less confidence in that after Friday night. I should probably go back to 7-5. And I actually think, if you ask me right now, 6-6 is not off the table. It was enough things. I shouldn't overreact to one game. Basketball is an even harder one, Larry, because the new teams in the league. That we haven't even seen a schedule yet. It's September. What day is it? September 3rd, and the men's basketball Big Ten schedule isn't out yet. So I don't know how the travel schedule will work out. I think it's a team that can sneak into the NCAA tournament yet. That is a brand new roster. Six new players out of the 16, three transfers, three freshmen. It's Greg Gard's got his work done to create chemistry, to create some continuity. And I will say this. I'm more fascinated by this season probably I've been since – in a long time. I just think it's going to be fun to see the new team, new players.
Jim, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thanks, always. It's been fun. This hour has flown by.
Yeah, the hour did fly by. Jim Polzin, sports reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal. I hope you'll come back and be with us again. Coming up, we'll take a look at women's weightlifting. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks so much for joining us today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, and talking now about Olympic weightlifting and the story of Mary Tyson Lappin. She is a weightlifter. Mary's a weightlifter from Eau Claire, Wisconsin. She earned fifth place at the Paris Olympics. Mary also won silver at the 2023 International Weightlifting Federation World Championships and has won a number of gold medals in her career. As we talk with Mary, I hope you'll join in. What are your questions for an athlete who is at the Olympic Games? Are you interested in weightlifting? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Mary Tyson Lappin, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Hi, thank you.
Well, first, congratulations on your fifth place finish at the Olympics. What did you enjoy most about going to your, this was your first Olympics?
Yes, this was my first Olympics. There was a pretty long list of things I enjoyed. I was there for a full month, so there was a lot of things that I got to see just in the city and do, like, when it came to training and kind of, like, Olympic experience and kind of look at the village and what we had to offer there, what they had to offer us as athletes and whatnot. The opening ceremony was obviously really awesome. I actually got to do kind of something kind of fun. I got to teach Snoop Dogg how to weightlift, so that was kind of fun. I never really had that on my bingo card of what I was going to do when I was there, but that happened. Yeah, and then I just, honestly, I love competing. I was a little bit bummed with how I did at the meet, but I that's just how it happens. Sometimes you kind of hope that you do better and do the best you can on the day that matters, and sometimes you don't. So it was still a really great experience, and I'm glad and happy for the sacrifices that I've made to kind of make that team and whatnot. But yeah, overall, it was a really great experience.
Friends and family, any of them get to come along?
Yeah, so I actually had about, I think it was about 40 people came.
Wow.
So it was like with friends, family, my husband, a lot of my gym, my friends from the gym came, just weightlifting members in general, like in the USA weightlifting community. We had a lot of really like just dedicated people. I think part of why so many people wanted to come was just because of the last Olympics being so, you know, no one could go, no one could be a spectator. So when this one was in a cool city like Paris, a lot of people wanted to do it. Yeah, it was good.
I wonder, you must have met athletes from many countries. Was anybody in particular who maybe inspired you?
Well, I've kind of been on the same kick as everybody else in the United States / world right now with like women's basketball. So I met Asia Wilson, who is, you know, obviously a really amazing basketball player, and she was really sweet and really nice, and she was really, you know, she kind of had that same type of attitude that we all had during the Olympics when it came to just being excited for competing for Team USA and excited about, you know, switching pins and things like that. And it was cool to see somebody at that high profile of an athlete that was excited to be at something that we were all in, because obviously being like in the WNBA and being such a star in that, in her own field, you know, having her this excited about something that we are doing was actually really cool. And it kind of made me realize like, oh, I guess these are just like regular people, you know, they're just really, really good at the stuff they chose to do. So and she was probably the one I was most excited to meet.
Well, you're really good at what you do, and you have the most interesting history. When it comes to the, you haven't always been a weightlifter. In fact, you used to you were involved in other things in track and field.
Correct. Yeah, I did. I did all sports growing up. My sisters and I am one of four girls, oldest of four girls, and my parents had us try pretty much everything just to see, you know, what we liked, and some stuff we liked, some stuff we didn't care for, and track and field was one of those things that my whole family was really into, and so it was. I was very fortunate enough where it helped me pay for school and for college and whatnot. So that was something that I really enjoyed, and I had a pretty successful career in that sport. And then after I got done with college track and field, my plan was actually to take the summer off, and then I never got into it again. So basically what happened was I took that summer off, and I felt really good, and I felt like I had kind of given my all. And so I really had no regrets as an athlete from that sport. So I switched my focus over into track and field and or into coaching, the coaching side of it, rather than being an athlete. And that kind of made my transition from being an athlete to not an athlete a little bit easier, because I still got to be around the sport that I loved. And then about 3.5 years later, after I hadn't done anything athletic, I got a call from USA Weightlifting, and they wanted to talk to me about basically some lists that they had seen from when I was in college, when I was in track, and basically some videos that one of my friends showed them of how strong I was back then, and wanted me to try weightlifting. And I was like, I think I'm probably good. I've been pretty content with walking my dogs and just being like, you know, a normal working out person that doesn't work like super hard or lift super heavy. And it took probably like a 15-minute conversation to talk me into it. So I ended up kind of, they must be pretty good at talking into people into things, because it didn't take a whole lot. But I ended up, again, trying that. And basically right in the beginning, end of 2017, beginning of 2018 was my first meet. And yeah, now I'm not coaching track anymore. I am, again, fortunate enough to be able to, you know, finance the life that my husband and I live, and he works a good job, and I make some money in weightlifting, and so we have a pretty simple but put good life, and that's kind of what I've been doing now the last couple of years, is just doing weightlifting. So really good sponsors and good people supporting me, and that's kind of the plan for the next little bit here.
I'm wondering now, you coached at, I know you coached at UW Oshkosh. What did coaching teach you about yourself as an athlete?
So I think it's just like, so obviously there's different levels. So like when I was an athlete, I competed at Division I, and so I didn't have a ton of experience at Division III, which is what Oshkosh is. I learned very quickly that the best kids in Division III, the best kids at those schools in the, you know, the WIAC conference in Wisconsin, the best kids in those conferences could easily compete in Division I. So it kind of taught me, you know, that those types of athletes that will work that hard for not getting paid, but it's, you know, it's pretty cool, and it's almost more rewarding as a coach to see that. And so when I think of, you know, me getting into weightlifting late, and I think of me doing track for so much of my life and starting, like I said, weightlifting as a 28-year-old, I kind of think about those kids and the hard work that they put in, and the kids that I was teammates with and maybe didn't work as hard as the kids I coached because they were kind of just there for the money, you know? And mm-hmm. I see these kids at Oshkosh that were doing it for free just for the love of the game, you know? And so I try to kind of channel that when I'm working hard too, because I think it's important if you commit to something that you commit all the way in. And that's something that I saw every day with my kids that I coached. And that's why, honestly, it was so hard to leave, because they did such a good job and they worked so hard, and they had such a special place in my heart for so many years. And I really didn't want to leave, but I couldn't really coach and compete. It was too hard to do both. So
Yeah. I want to talk about that whole process. I mean, you must have had to put a lot of work in to get that kind of success, and probably with some good coaching along the way.
Oh yeah. Yeah. No, I've had some really good coaches. My friend actually started coaching me when I first started weightlifting, just because he knew about the sport and he was a buddy of mine that I've had for a while. And then he was pretty busy, so I ended up having a different coach for a couple years. And then when COVID happened, I really wanted a coach that was super familiar with coaching remote, because back then in 2020, I was not really willing to leave where I was living. So my coach that I had for a while wasn't super into remote coaching, so it was kind of hard sometimes to communicate and whatnot. And a lot of coaches kind of specialize in remote coaching. So I found someone that I really, really trusted, and we started working together in April 2020. And he worked with me with my job because I didn't quit work until 2020, well, I guess the end of 2021. And so he worked with me, and we kind of like made things work while I was still working full time. For a while there, I was getting my master's at the same time as lifting and working full time. So like I've always been like very used to doing a lot at once. So I think sometimes even now I struggle with, you know, making sure I stick with the routine because I don't have as busy of a life as I used to. So I try to like, my husband would disagree with that. I think he would probably say that I find plenty of things to sign up for and do. But yeah, so I think it's just I've been used to a busy life my whole life, and now. Now things are maybe a little bit more relaxed and whatnot, but that's kind of the plan, you know, is try to, especially up to the Olympics, was go all in and kind of cut the fat from the different things in my life that were not serving me and not, you know, not helping me be a better weightlifter. And like I said, unfortunately, that kind of meant my job, but luckily I was able to receive some funding with weightlifting and whatnot. So, like you said, I did work really, really hard to get where I am, and I plan on working really, really hard for a little bit longer and kind of see where we end up with that.
Yeah. I'm wondering if you have four more years down the road you're thinking yet for the Olympics.
Yeah, I'm not sure yet. Yeah, I mean, that's a really hard one because I think if the Olympics in 28 were not in LA, I think it would be a super easy I'm done. But the fact that the Olympics are in our country, it's really hard to be, you know, to completely say no to it. So like I said, I'm just kind of like taking it day by day. There's a world championship next year for weightlifting in Norway, and I really want to do that. My family's like pretty Norwegian, and it's somewhere I've never been, and I think it would be a really cool trip. So I think that's kind of like my trip right now that I'm training super, super hard for. And I'll kind of take it basically year by year, kind of see. And if I'm feeling pretty good in, say, 2026 or the end of 2025, I'll kind of revisit if I want to keep training and whatnot. But I think the last Olympic cycle, it was really easy to say, okay, I have 4 years. I guess it was three because Olympics of 2020 were technically in 2021. But I think that was really easy to say, okay, I have 3 years to train really hard. The plan is to make the Olympics, and then we'll reassess. I think this year will be, this type of Olympic cycle will be basically year by year instead of that whole entire cycle. Mm. We'll just play it by year.
Listener called, couldn't stay with us, wondering how you and other weightlifters prevent long-term wear and tear on your joints and muscles.
Yeah. So I think it's actually like a pretty big myth. I mean, of course, like we're going to have things that bother us and we're going to have, you know, issues maybe with body parts if you don't train correctly. But a lot of like the really cool things that a lot of people don't know, which is really like fun to teach, is like there are super awesome lasting things that will happen to our body that will actually make us like super strong as we age and whatnot. So obviously we don't want to train, you know, 7, 8, 9 times a week and train as heavy as we can every single day for the rest of our life. But there are things that if you are really careful and you have a good coach that, you know, listens to your body and you communicate with your coach, there are things that, you know, are actually going to help you age better. They're going to make you stronger. They're going to make your bones stronger and your muscles stronger. And you're not going to, you know, have such a hard time when you get older, if you say you fall or if you, you know, are doing outside work or things like that. So, like I said, I don't think it's the best idea to train as heavy as I trained for the rest of my life. But I think if you're smart about it, there's actually things that will help you as you get older.
What would be an example? Oh, sorry. I was going to say, an example of one of those things?
Of something that will help you as you get older?
Yeah.
I mean, I think something just as simple as like a back squat, you know, like I think people see the back squat, they see like the internet, they see social media, they see like the things that surface that are, you know, popular and whatnot. And you see these huge back squats and these huge people. And in reality, like there's a back squat you can do. You can just put an empty bar on your back, and if you practice like good form, like your body's still going to get strong with an empty bar. You know, you keep good technique and you keep good form, and your legs and muscles and knees and all those things are going to feel really good. They're going to feel, I always like to think about it like a well-oiled machine. You know, if you don't work your body and work your joints, you're going to end up like the Tin Man, you know, and we don't want to be like the Tin Man in the world. So we find, like, again, there's definitely a happy medium between lifting super heavy and, you know, maybe not making the best decisions as we get older when it comes to pushing our body too much. But I think that there's a misconception and thinking that you have to lift super heavy to be in the gym. I coach a lot of people that don't lift super heavy, and they just are constantly working on technique and, you know, just feeling better as human beings. So I think that you think about your body, like I said, like the Tin Man, and if you kind of oil it up and work it nice and do things to take care of it, then it'll help you as you get older, even if it's not much weight at all.
Let's talk a little bit more about the sport of weightlifting itself. I'm sure I know there's, you know, what are the weightlifting movements, for example, you know, what goes on?
Yeah. So basically what it is a competition is consists of a snatch and a clean and jerk. So the snatch is the first lift. We get three attempts at the snatch. And basically what happens is the bar starts on the floor and you need to, in one fluid movement, put it above your head. So that's the first event. The second one, it's all in one day. The whole competition takes about 2 hours only. The second one is called the clean and jerk. And the clean and jerk, typically you'd be able to clean and jerk heavier than you can snatch. So you'll clean it. Basically, you take that bar from the floor. You're going to pull it up your legs, up your body, catch it on your shoulders with your elbows going through. Kind of looks like it's called basically a front squat where your elbows would be pointing through. You're holding it on your basically your shoulders. And then you get to take a short rest. I'm talking like a couple seconds. You readjust your hands, take a big breath. And then you're going to dip your bar and then drive it over your head. So, again, the difference in the two lifts is one is one fluid motion from floor to overhead. The other is two motions. One is, you know, the second one is going from the floor to your shoulders, shoulders to overhead. So, again, you get three attempts at both. At the competitions, the bar starts at the lightest weight. And it will end at the heaviest weight. So a lot of times there are people that will be done lifting by the time the heavier weights even start. And so you kind of have to have a coach that understands the competition and the counting of when you're going to go, when you should warm up, when it's going to be your turn and whatnot. So there's a 10-minute break between the snatch and the clean and jerk. Everyone takes their snatches, 10-minute break. Everyone takes their clean and jerks, and it's over. The way that it's scored is you take your snatch and you add it with your clean and jerk, and that's your total. At most meets, you can get a medal in the snatch, a medal in the clean and jerk, and a medal in the total. But at the Olympics, you can only get a medal in the total. So, it's a lot of times people, I would say, are either a little bit better at the snatch or a little bit better in the clean and jerk. But the goal is obviously to be the best you can at both. So that's kind of how the competition works. Most people, I would say at my level, you don't really want to compete more than three times a year. Unfortunately, with the way that the qualification for the Olympics worked, we had to compete seven times a year, which was really, really not great. That's kind of what I touched on before. If you're trying to keep your body super healthy, I don't recommend lifting in seven meets in a year, especially when they're all over the world. But that's already happened. Like, that's not the plan forever again. So hopefully the qualification gets rewritten and keeps the athlete's health a little bit more in mind, because even mentally it got to be very draining. So
I would think so. Seven meets, and you had to all over the world you were running.
Yeah. So between April of 2023 and April of 2024, I competed in Argentina, Cuba, Saudi Arabia, Santiago, Chile, Doha, Bulgaria, and Phuket, Thailand. So I was in basically 370 days, I was in those seven countries. And yes, the competitions were tough because you have to lift as heavy as you can, and typically you wouldn't do it that often. But honestly, I think what really got to me was all that travel, especially because from where we are, obviously, like, the flight from here to the Middle East or here to Thailand are really not that enjoyable. So that was a lot of the stuff that got to me. But again, hopefully the next time we're not having to travel that much.
Oh, my goodness. Well, you must have air miles coming out of your ears.
I do. Yeah. Luckily, that helped a little bit with especially my husband's trip to Paris. I think his Paris trip was pretty much covered because of all that stuff. So that was actually nice.
Oh, man. And how would you describe the community, the weightlifting community?
I think it's really good. I mean, I have obviously, like, with I've been in it for a while, and I have, like, I lived in Wisconsin. I'm from there. I grew up there. I'm actually here for the week. But I live in Bloomington, Indiana right now, so I kind of have, like, communities in both places. But that's the nice thing about even on these really hard days I found some really, really amazing people in the sport to support me and, you know, pick me up when I'm having bad days or remind me, like, you're doing a great job or remind me to be confident when I forget myself. So it really is a really, really supportive community. And I think even whether you just started and joined a gym and you have no idea what you're doing or you competed at the Olympics, people want to help you and they want to help you get stronger and they want to help you improve. I just think it's a really cool sport because everyone can do it. It's not, you know, it's not something that it's only for super strong people that are big. There's weight classes in the sport. So it's, you know, everyone can do it, whether they're super tiny and maybe they're not going to turn into a big, tall, super big person. There's some really incredible athletes that are very short and very small, and they're so incredibly strong. It's mind-boggling. And then there's, you know, men can do it, women can do it, you know, little kids can do it. There's elderly people that do it. So again, it's a really great sport. There's different divisions, there's different age groups, there's different, you know, everything. So everyone kind of has the space. So that's just it's a good sport for anyone to try.
Yeah. You know, this Olympics, there was a conversation about body positivity and how healthy, strong bodies don't always look the same. And I loved some comments I saw of yours relating to that.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think that's just kind of the same thing. Going off what I just said is, like, there's plenty of bodies that don't look the same, you know. And I think that, again, with social media, like, I'm 33, so I grew up with not a ton of social media, thank goodness. And so as it got more popular, you start to see, like, you know, the Instagram models, you see these women that, like, probably don't do a whole lot of working out, but probably spent some time editing photos or getting plastic surgery. And, you know, you see these things like that, and I feel bad, and I hope that girls and young boys and young girls don't see that and expect that to be, you know, realistic, because there's so many, like I said, like, great editing tutorials and editing features on phones now. So I think it's, like, with the Olympics, just super important to kind of use that platform that people had to promote that there are a lot of different body types that can be healthy, you know. I'm a super heavy weightlifter. I do regular physicals. I do regular, you know, appointments with my doctor to make sure that I'm healthy. I have family history that would say that I need to be careful, you know, with things like that. And I think that's important to kind of keep an eye on, and I do. And so my health markers are all good, and I try to stay healthy as I can. And I may not look like everybody else on the internet that has, like, you know, big followings and whatnot, but I think it's important for people, especially, like, big people in bigger bodies, to know that the gym is a really good place for them, whether they want to do weightlifting or, you know, just strength training in general or just go to the gym. I think they need to know that they belong, because, I mean, it's just a good place. It's a good place to go, and there's a community in it, whether it's in weightlifting or in, you know, powerlifting or strength training or just regular gym goer. It's important to know that those places are for everybody, even if you look a little different.
Mary, it has been a real pleasure talking with you. I appreciate your time very much, and look forward to watching your career, Ben. See,
yeah, I really appreciate it.
It's been fun and really interesting. Thank you so much, Mary.
Of course, yeah. Thank you so much for having me.
Mary Tyson Lappin, weightlifter, just returned from the Olympics. It was really fun talking with her today. And hopefully I'll get a chance to talk with her again. We're going to turn our attention to curling next. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining in today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're going to turn our attention to curling. The game of curling made its way to the U.S., I think, in the early 1800s and has flourished in Wisconsin. And we're going to talk about the sport of curling and an upcoming championship between the curlers from the U.S. and those from Canada. Two guests for you. Sydney Schrader is with us today. She's team captain of USA and of USA women's curling. She is the skip for the team, also part of the Madison Curling Club. Sydney, welcome to the show.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for having me. Excited to be here.
Great to have you with us. Randy Furbe is with us as well. I hope I got your pronunciation right, Randy, and your name.
Yeah. Furby, yeah.
Furby, okay. He is 6-time Canadian and 4-time world curling champion, Canada Sports Hall of Fame inductee, and an Everest Curling Executive Committee member. And Randy, thank you for joining us as well.
I'm glad to be here.
So as we talk with our two guests, I hope you'll join in. Are you a fan of curling? What attracted you to the sport? What would you like to know about the members of Team USA or maybe making the team? Want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Sydney, you may know a friend of mine. His name's Dan Detmers. And he is with the McFarland rink. And he took me over there once and said, I'll show you how to do it, and how to curl. And I put on those the curling shoes. And I on my first attempt, I made an extraordinary flop across the ice. Which I actually wish somebody had been shooting some video, because I would have liked to see that. It was the most extraordinary flop, I think, in the history of curling across the ice. oh my goodness. Well, maybe we should even start. I know there's there are people who are very familiar with curling who are listening in, but what are the basics and how difficult is it to learn? It looks so easy when you watch others who really know what they're doing do it.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a pretty common question we get is, it looks like everyone can do it. And the flop is common, unfortunately, but if you can get yourself back up, it is a great time, and it is not that hard to learn. It's very hard to get good at, but anyone can really play it. That's part of why I love it so much. I've curled against people who are in their 90s, and I've curled against people who are 12. So it's truly for everyone.
So it's, I was kind of surprised at first at the weight of the rock that you have to throw. To you, is it physically demanding?
Yes, it's definitely a sport of longevity, you throw quite a few rocks in a game, so it gets tiring for sure. And I don't sweep very much, but the girls on my team that do, yeah, their arms are tired.
Randy, turn to you for a second. What are the common strategies used in curling matches? I find that really, really fascinating to look at those strategies.
Yeah, I think I'll go back a little bit on that. I think most people that are watch curling or are intrigued by curling, they get addicted to watching how we call the game. It's kind of like chess in a way, even though I don't like using that that definition. But I mean, at every level, there's a different degree of of strategy and whatnot. But, I mean, if you just show up with your three guys or three friends at night or however many friends you're going to go out and just try to experiment with the game, I guess you just get in the hack where you put your foot in, you throw the rock out, and you know, you just try to get it into the house, which is at the far end, and you play X amount of ends and who's ever closest. But once you get to the top level, there's a lot of strategies with guards and corner guards and hit and rolls and all that stuff. But I mean, that takes years and years of time and practice to develop the strategy. I mean, there's people that play this game that have played it for years that they're still not on this strategic level as the top competitive teams. But again, you don't need to have that to enjoy and play the game on a daily basis or a fun basis with your friends.
Yeah, it's amazing to me to watch, though. And you're right. I mean, I know some, Dan Detmers, but many other friends who have done it for a long time. They're reasonably good at it, but they're certainly not at a level that you see, for example, in the Olympics or these upcoming this upcoming championship between the U.S. and Canada, which I'm really looking forward to. Looking forward to seeing.
Yeah, so are we.
Yeah, I bet you are. Steve emailed us, by the way, and Steve says, thanks for talking curling today. They started a new club in Rhinelander last year in kind of northern Wisconsin, getting ready for the second season this fall. First new club in decades in Wisconsin, great sport for communities, all ages, families. Stick and wheelchair para curling as well.
Yeah.
So, you want to comment?
Yeah.
Randy?
Absolutely. I'd love to comment on that. I mean, traditionally in Canada, we have, we've probably got 750 curling clubs in Canada. I mean, it goes hand in hand with a hockey rink. And, you know, when you got a hockey rink, you got a curling club right next door to it. So traditionally, I mean, we go back 100 years in curling that it's been traditionally been four women, four men playing the game. And over the years, you know, we've kind of come across times where it's hard to find four people to commit to a weekly or a biweekly league. So we've developed, or curling has developed, you know, stick curling, where you can play with two people now. You can go up there and just push, you know, your stick is attached to the rock, which is very interesting. And you don't have to, you know, you don't have to develop the proper skills, I guess, from sliding out. So it makes it enjoyable just to be out on the ice and making the same shots, even though you don't got the sliding down and all that sort of stuff. You know, there's mixed doubles now. There's all kinds of curling. You know, there's wheelchair curling. It just involves a more wide array of people to enjoy the sport. So we just got to keep developing our game and looking at ways to encourage more people to participate.
Yeah, and I got to believe that some people may start out in that easier fashion and maybe turn to the traditional form.
Correct. You know, and the traditional sport in some aspect, I'm not saying it's going away, but you need more people to play. You need 30 teams or 20 teams of four. But if you play with your wife in a mixed doubles league or something like that, well, you only need two of you people, you know, two players instead of four. So it's kind of easier to get together. And these are kind of new events coming along in the last few years. So it's taken a while to process it, and, you know, and for all curling clubs to adapt to that. So it's a process, but it's coming along.
Sydney, your position is skip, and I've got a question from someone. What does that mean?
No, that is a great question. I guess I don't know why it's called the skip, but what it basically means is I handle a lot of the strategy on the team. I'm the one that's yelling sweep at the sweepers, so I get the fun job. And then I also get all the pressure of throwing the last two rocks. So it's the most fun in my opinion, but it's one of the hardest.
So what does a typical training session look like?
Well, it kind of depends on the time of year. Right now we've been traveling a little bit to get ice time, but we try to do as much team shots as we can. my team has actually only played together for this last season. That was our first season together, and it went very well.
Obviously.
But, yeah. But, no, we talk strategy with our coach on and off the ice all the time. We watch old games, you know, anything we can do just to consume more curling and get more comfortable.
You also work as an engineer in Spring Green. How do you balance prep for competitions with your work?
Very carefully. No, everyone else on the team is pretty willing to help me accommodate with work. I work, 45 plus hours a week. So they help with a lot of the logistical things outside of it so that I'm able to just focus mostly on ice and do the strategy and throw as many rocks as we can when we get the chance.
Well, let's talk. Wait a second. I want to talk about the Everest North American Curling Club Championships and what that entails in just a minute. But a reminder, Randy Furby is with us today. He is a world curling champion, a four-time world curling champion, Canada's Sports Hall of Fame inductee, and an Everest Curling Executive Committee member. Sydney Schrader is Team USA women's skip. I'm Larry Mueller. You can join in with a question or comment. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. You're listening to WPR News. Taking a look at the sport of curling today and the upcoming event, the Everest North American Curling Club Championships, the North American, and that means the USA team versus Canada's team, something that I guess, Randy, hasn't happened in the past?
No. This is a brand new event just give a little background on Everest. We sponsor a lot of curling events in Canada. We've been sponsoring the Canadian seniors for 10 years, and we sponsor the Canadian club championships now for 4 years. And the CEO of Everest, he's actually based out of Houston, Texas, believe it or not. And it's a North America-wide company. And so every year we get together, myself and him, and we try to figure out a way to make the sport bigger and bring more viewership to our sport. So this is something we thought about, a couple of years ago, where we would like to take it. And so we were sitting around a year and a half ago, at least that long ago, we says, well, why don't we come up with an Everest North America Championship, USA versus Canada? And it just so happened that USA had an event that they determined a club winner, and Canada determines a club winner. So it was kind of a natural thing to put together. So We hired a team, and we got TV on board, and this is going to be the first time ever that curling is going to be broadcast across North America live at the same time outside of the Olympics. I mean, but that's more of a different thing. But this is the first time curling is going to be broadcast live across North America, and we're thrilled about that. And these curlers should be excited about it also. You know, we got a major network picking it up, so it's it's going to be, I'm quite nervous moving forward because we're 2 weeks out, and and hopefully everything's going to run pretty smoothly. So, again, so that was kind of a start of it, and where it's going to end, we've had conversation. Maybe we take this globally. We're a club championship from Sweden and Scotland and so forth and so forth. Maybe we eventually get together, but we decided to start a little smaller and just have USA versus Canada, which is a great rivalry in all of sports. You know, when Canada's playing the U.S., it doesn't matter if it's hockey or, I guess, it's just pretty much hockey. And, we get a lot of feed on that. So we're hoping to get to start it off here this year with a great year and great viewership.
Well, I play in a golf tournament every year in Canada, so the talk always turns to who's better, and of course Canada has such a history, and but it's always fun to have that kind of conversation. Sydney, how'd your team wind up in this event?
So we all sort of knew each other loosely from growing up curling juniors. You know, the world of junior curling in the U.S. anyway is quite small.
Yeah.
Still great competition, but quite small, so you get to know everyone. And then after college, I moved to Madison mostly for curling, to be honest, and picked up the other three. Our lead was kind of a fluke, but it was a great matchup, and you know, we've loved curling together ever since.
Well, I love it. Barry in who's near Black River Falls, we'll go to you. Hi, Barry.
Well, hi, thanks for taking my call. I grew up, I'm in my mid-70s, but I grew up in Superior, Wisconsin, and Bud Somerville was a local hero and a well-known curler throughout the curling world. But the popularity of curling wasn't nearly what it seems to be today. I'm wondering if your guest could opine on the why has curling become so popular?
Ah, good question.
I can touch on that a little bit. You know, by the way, even though I'm from Canada, I've heard of Bud Somerville. I think I even had the pleasure of meeting him years and years ago, and he definitely was a forefront curler for the U.S. because I believe he won the world championship back when I'm dating myself probably 40 years ago now, but I know he was very competitive and very well respected in the curling world. Now, I think why curling I think the Olympics has got lots to do with that. You know, I mean, anytime the Olympics is on, it brings more eyes to your sport, whether it's a top level sport or a lower sport. But people are always intrigued by curling because of the strategy. I mean, curling looks like an easy sport that anybody can do, and it's not. But again, I would encourage anybody to go give it a go. I mean, these athletes put a lot of time and effort into it, and they're basically common people. You know, they all got jobs. They're not high paid athletes, and I think the general public likes that when they see, you know, a regular person achieving a really special goal. So I think that's part of it. I mean, there's a lot of curling clubs being built across the U.S. and worldwide, and all we need to do is for the sport to grow even more is to get people to try it, because I think once people try our sport, they love it. I've never heard of a player or a participants say, nah, this is not for me. Everybody likes the sport, and I think it'll grow from there. But the problem is getting people into the curling club to try it.
Yeah, I think we go back to the U.S. Winning the gold medal, the men's team winning the gold medal. I'm trying to remember. It was a fascinating story, and I think you're right, Randy. That's probably where curling really kind of took off. Sydney, you would agree with that or not?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Definitely after the men's team won gold at the Olympics, I think you saw a huge increase. And it's cool because some of those guys on that team are from Madison as well.
Yeah.
So it definitely helped around the area here.
It did indeed. Barry, thanks. Ray and Broadhead, your turn. Hi, Ray.
Yeah, so my question was just, I know Randy has played internationally a bunch. I was just curious if there is anything like very noticeable about the strategy in men's curling versus women's curling.
Yeah, maybe you could both comment on that.
You know what? My opinion, I think, is very similar. A lot of women follow men's and vice versa, so they pick up little tidbits and whatnot along the way. But generally, the strategy is pretty much the same because, I mean, in curling, it's not like baseball or football where you don't have the strength or whatever. But generally, you know, if you're watching, you follow a sport, it'd be pretty much the same.
All right. And Sydney, you would agree with that?
Yeah, I definitely agree. I'd say maybe more at the beginner level. The guys tend to throw a lot more takeouts because that's a heck of a lot more fun. but yeah, I'd say once you get up there, it's pretty much the same. Everyone's got to be able to throw everything.
John in Onalaska, we'll give you a chance. Hi, John.
Hi. I was wondering, I've been watching curling, you know, on TV and so forth, and I often wonder how you know the skip knows. You know, is it an environmental? For instance, if your auditorium or your rink is filled with people, it must warm up the ice, and then it gets slipperier. And if it, and or also, what else? Well, that would be one question. Maybe there's different ice, that, and you have to know or sense that before you start the game.
Yeah, well, good question, John. Well, Sydney, let's go to you, and then Randy as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm not an ice maker, so I'm not going to be able to tell you the physics behind it. But having people on the ice versus playing in a regular curling club makes a huge difference. And typically you get practice before a game, so that helps you get comfortable. But you do have to, on the fly, adjust as conditions change. Ice makers do a great job of keeping it consistent, but you can only control so much. So part of that's just years of experience reading ice for 15 years now. You get a feel for it.
Randy, anything to add there?
Yeah, actually being an ice maker is an art. It's not like they go into this inside a curling club or an arena and they just put the ice down and away you go. There's an art to it. There's humidifiers in place. There's airflow in place. And I know what you're saying, that it does, you know, I played in arenas where it's like you're playing in a t-shirt. It's crazy how warm it is, and yet the ice 3 feet below from your head is maintaining a proper temperature, and that's where the ice makers come in. I mean, obviously the ice is measured all the time and monitored all the time, and they keep close track of it. So it's definitely an art form to get the right ice. But generally, in a arena, the ice is better than in a curling club because there's more. They got more technical and more machines and blah 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 and all that sort of stuff to take care of it.
Yeah, I would think so. And before I forget, I do. You mentioned the championship is the Everest North American Curling Club Championship, women's is coming up Tuesday, September 17th.
Mm-hmm. Yep, correct.
And where do we watch it?
Yeah, sports 7 p.m. Central, and then the men's is September 18th, 7 p.m. Central on CBS also. And it, you know, tune in. Please tune into this. I mean, we need eyes on this, and I think you're going to be pleasantly surprised at what we got planned. It's going to be not a traditional broadcast. It's going to be kind of exciting and different and kind of cool. You know, we're trying to go the way of the younger people instead of the older people traditionally, which has watched this game. So we got some interesting things planned for this event.
Hmm. And Sydney, you're going to be in it. So what are some of those interesting things?
Great question. I don't know if I'm privy to all that information, but we were told, you know, when we won, this is going to be a very unique event. The energy is going to be high. Like Randy said, we're trying to go towards a younger crowd, which works because I'm the oldest one on the team at 27. so I think it's going to be very high energy. And I think it's just going to be super exciting, you know, great time. I'm very, very excited to play in it.
And where is it held?
Oh, it's in it's at the Rock Creek Curling Club in Lafayette, Colorado.
The Rock Creek Curling Club in that's a lot of C's there in Colorado, and it's September 17th, 6 p.m. and 7 p.m. Central Time, and it's on the CBS Sports Network. So. Yep. And then the 18th, it's once again 6 p.m. Mountain Time, 7 p.m. our time on the CBS Sports Network. This has been a great pleasure. Randy, Sydney, thank you so much for being with us today. I really appreciate it.
No, thank you for having me. You know, I think this is great. It's a great awareness thing. And anytime I can help out with the sport of curling, I love to give my two cents worth, I guess you could say.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Randy Ferbe and Sydney Schrader, our guests today. I'm looking forward to watching those events. It's the first one between Team USA and Team Canada. Well, I tell you what, thanks for joining in today. Our producers, Clara Neipert and Joel Patnaud, our technical directors, Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins, our executive director is Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. Again, thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on WPR News.